The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. How much of your thinking do you leave to the experts? How much of what you think about anything from the weather to world news do you leave to experts who are paid to do the thinking? You're living in a time of increasing specialization where when people want to sell a home, they go to the realtor or to an automobile dealer for their automobiles or to a boat dealer to get the very latest on outboard motors. And people trust the specialists today. You'll find people will believe in almost anything so long as someone with a doctor's degree told them so or someone who is supposed to really know. How much do you know about the theory of evolution? How much do you know about paleontology, zoology, astronomy, biology, some of the natural and physical sciences? Now, as a college professor, I am increasingly amazed every single year when asking for a showing of hands of college students who have studied in some of the natural sciences, and I want to find out what kind of a background they may have in geology or some of the sciences that will help them to understand some of the big questions I'm about to put to them about the origin of the universe, about the origin of man, about all life on this earth, about what man is, where he came from, why he is on the earth, and where is he going. I asked for a showing of hands about their experience in paleontology, biology, zoology, physics, or perhaps geology or astronomy. And you know, I'm amazed. Apparently many of the high schools aren't even teaching those subjects anymore, except as a sort of a lick and a promise in a general science course. And that it seems only those who desire to really specialize and oftentimes quite early in life pursue these courses very far. And also in teaching a class about family relations concerned with a home, with home management, with child rearing and preschool education, I will ask people to explain, especially some of the girls in the class, some of the simple things about household physics. How would they teach their child where their air that they breathe comes from? Take him outside and show him the grass on the lawn and tell him about the process of osmosis. All of them look sort of blank. They wonder, well, that would be kind of tough. I don't know how I would do that. Well, the average girl in college, I mean college-age sophomores and seniors, do not know how to teach their children some of these simple things. Why is the moon all white at one time of the month, and why is it just a crescent at another time of the month? And some of them would have a real tough time telling you how the moon rotates around the earth as they both rotate around the sun. And they would have a real tough time telling their little, questing, eager children prior to school age very much at all about household physics, simple household observations. How water is found in three forms, solid, liquid, and gas. Tell them what makes the pot bubble when mama's getting the coffee ready. Tell them what's behind the switch on the wall. Tell them what it is that causes green in plants. What is that thing they call chlorophyll? It's not just in toothpaste. You know, they finally came up with a name for it, but it's interesting to talk a little bit about household physics. But I find that the average wife doesn't even know about water contracting and expanding. Can't tell you that about 29.2 degrees, it's about as easily containable or can be contained in the smallest container possible. From then on, it expands in either direction. And they won't even take a glass of hot water and fill it full right out of the tap and let it sit 6 hours and bring their boy back in and show them how it's gone down a little bit, and not through evaporation either, but because that water literally contracted. And you know, you may be pretty much the same way, because like most people, you don't have time to study. It's too complex, too time-consuming, and so you leave it to the experts. Now, most people are pretty well convinced that evolution is true, and that there is no God. Those who claim there is a God seem to falter around with one peg leg and another one that's pretty wobbly. They don't have very much to stand upon, at least according to the paleontologists and evolutionists, and so usually they have a real heyday when they will corner a theologian on the air, on television, or in print. And they will demand to know of a theologian what causes accidents. Why did a little child die? They will say, what causes wars, or why does God allow war, if there is a God? And they will say, well, if there is a God, why doesn't he come down and walk and talk with us and eat meals with us and show himself to us? And they will ridicule the idea of a God. And right about that point, many theologians begin to apologize. Matter of fact, they even have a type of study in theological institutions called apologetics. We're sorry, but Here's what we believe. We try to reconcile, we try to harmonize what we believe with all that science presents as facts. Now, if you're honest with yourself, you will admit to yourself that so far as you are concerned, if you put science and all of the available knowledge of science on one side, and theology and all available knowledge concerning God on the other side, you would have to say that science seems to have such a tremendous preponderance of available evidence and such a fantastic collection of brilliant minds and such great acceptance in the modern day world that there is simply no question left. And sitting on the sidelines as a layman and listening to some of the gasping, wheezing screams of religion, seeing all the formal ceremonies, I would begin to think, like a lot of teenagers are today, that maybe God is for the old people. Because a lot of theologians, you'd be shocked to find out how many preachers believe in evolution. And you would be shocked further to find out how many of them absolutely accept the idea that there probably isn't any God, but that Christ lived and he was just a fine man, sort of on a par with a lot of other fine men that you read of, like Buddha, or Muhammad, or Zoroaster, or somebody else. There are people like that in history. And so they put Christ on an even par with some people even say he was almost as good as Shakespeare. That's right. And a lot of people are out teaching other people about Christ and what he said, and they'll quote from Shakespeare, or the Kant or Dante or somebody else, and then they'll quote from Christ, and it's just as if he's a teacher like anybody else. You would be absolutely shocked to find out how deeply entrenched is the idea of evolution, and how absolutely unprovable, how shocked through with holes, how filled with yawning insurmountable gaps, and how absolutely erroneous that teaching is. But the only way you're going to do that is to be a little more observant yourself. To quit leaving your opinions to the experts. To quit using the old dodge and the catchphrase, well, there are other people paid to think about that and they know. No, only if you are willing to spend a little bit of time to at least trust a little more the extent of your own observations and to ask a few questions of your own, are you ever going to reconcile it? Now, why should you bother? Well, simply because of this. If you have made a strange mistake, and if there is a great God, I mean, if there is really a God, and let's clarify what I mean by that, I don't mean the life principle or the first cause or blind chance, I don't mean Mother Nature. I mean a God who is a literal, personal, spirit being composed of spirit just as much as you are composed of flesh. A God who literally sent his own son into this earth. A God who caused that son to be resurrected from the dead, and that absolutely by a fantastic miracle caused him to walk out of his tomb. And as shocking as it sounds, to ascend up to heaven. I mean, all those claims of the Bible, if such a God does exist, and if you have been ignoring what he says, and if you have been violating his laws, which is not only so he as a hanging judge can call you into account and retribution later, but which is the very reasons why you've got heartaches and headaches and hangovers today, why your marriage isn't as happy as it should be, and why your job doesn't work out, and why you're unhappy and miserable or kind of half fulfilled and wishing you could enjoy more, why you're grasping and seizing and reaching out at life and never quite achieving. If you'd settle down and realize that the reason for a lot of those unhappinesses is simply broken laws, if you come to find all of that by a little bit of study, then you will have been making a rather weird mistake to assume there is no God, to assume science has all the evidence, to assume the preponderance of real thought and of intelligent research is on the side of science, and to assume that religious people must only dodge behind faith. That they've always got to say, as if with a careless wave of the hand, dismissing all known scientific knowledge, and say, well, I accept the Bible on faith. I accept that there is a God on faith. Oh, you should have faith, but my Bible says that faith is based upon absolute evidence, that faith is the evidence of things not seen. And in the first chapter of the book of Romans in the New Testament, whoever inspired it, God claims to have inspired the Apostle Paul to have written those words. That which is invisible, that which is otherwise not available and not discernible to your mind through the five senses about God, the invisible things of God, the Godhead, the God family, his divinity, are experienced and are proved by the physical things that are made, by this universe, by the earth, by all life that is upon it. God Almighty holds out to you so many billions of tons of evidence, it's almost laughable when you begin to look into it. But like a lot of people, you've probably been leaving it to the experts. Now, you know, as I've said, as a college professor, I find it's a little shocking at how little the average person does know about biology, of how absolutely unobservant the average person is in driving along in an automobile. They cannot read the terrain. In flying along in an airplane, and more people are traveling these days, they can look down below and their eyes do not pick out the obvious and the natural. And then their mind does not explain the way the crust and surface of this earth became the way it is. And it doesn't take all that amount of study. It's merely using your mind and observing and thinking about what you see. It's about time you began to wonder about paleontology and about evolution. Because you probably yourself, unless you're one of those rare exceptions, a specialist who went into the field, and what did you do it for if you are, but to learn it as quickly and as easily and with as few snags and snares along the way as you could, to get into your head everything you possibly could in order to take up the position you now occupy or to go on and teach it to others. And otherwise, if you're not a specialist in it, you probably didn't study it very much. And if you did, you only studied a lot of statements written by men who claim to know, the experts. But how many experts have you known who really questioned their textbooks? How many challenged the geologic succession of strata? How many ever wondered whether evolution is true and tried to put it to the test? Is it fair or unfair that we should be able to take the big claims of evolution and point to any species, any insect, any frog or bird or fish or even humankind itself and ask, could evolution be true if such and such is so? Or is that not the way to play the game? Is it blind man's buff? Is that the way to play the game? You assume that evolution is true and you blindfold your eyes to reality and you wander around with a pin in your hand, wondering where to pin the tail, or maybe who to tag as being the scapegoat and the one to be hanging on to all of the problems. Do you deny the problems? Do you say, well, look at all these learned men. Evolution, you might reason, is the product of educated, intelligent men. And I'll tell you this, I agree with that. But educated to what? Intelligent in what? God Almighty in the Bible, if there is a God, if you can prove it, and I can prove it to you, or you can prove it to yourself, has said that only the fool has said in his heart there is no God. So he says there are a lot of educated fools in the world. As a matter of fact, he said in the first chapter of the book of Romans that they, fancying that they themselves are wise, proclaiming to be wise, have become fools. And he said even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. Now, people are determined they're not going to have God interfering in their lives. And so with one fell swoop, they tried to do away with everything that smacks of creation. And they would like to have all of this fantastic universe, about which they admittedly know little, all of the thousands of bird, insect, and fish species, about which, again, they admittedly know little, and all of the complex operations of the human body and mind itself, conveniently stilled. Just silence all those millions of voices, and with one careless toss of the hand, decide that it all happened. By some strange occurrence, it all gradually came to be from nothing. Now, you talk about faith. That defies description. That kind of faith is really amazing, isn't it? Well, now, I want to ask a few questions of evolutionists again. How do evolutionists explain animal arithmetic? A lot of people flunked math courses by the thousands. A lot of struggling students today are beating their head against the wall trying to figure out how to add and subtract. And a lot of people just barely learn enough math in school to keep score at a bridge game. And beyond this, they have trouble. I notice people having trouble with television commercials all the time. Here's this low, low price. Of course, it's for 36 or better yet, maybe 42 months. Then it's only going to be about $40 a year, and it's only a few hundred dollars for the car. All you've got to do is to figure the two, and you paid almost double in some cases. I figured one deal I saw in a used car ad one time, it was 70% interest. I don't know how they get away with it. It was like the old joke that I've repeated years ago about Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy on the old program on the air years ago when Edgar Bergen had his dummy Charlie on his knee, and they would talk back and forth. Charlie said, oh, there is, or Edgar rather said to Charlie the dummy, there is no such thing as a perfect crime. And Charlie McCarthy, the dummy, said, "Oh, yeah? Have you ever bought a used car?" "Well, you know, you probably bought one yourself. You've heard about the little old lady from Pasadena who had the car up on blocks and never drove it. We have our jokes about the used car market. But, you know, a lot of people have a tough time with math. Now, I've talked to mathematicians and scientists who have worked in jet propulsion, who have been designers in some of the missile systems today, and they tell me that even though they have endeavored in a specific and a highly specialized scientific field, they did not study the human sciences, they didn't study the biological sciences, that they sort of disdained this, they left that to other people, that just because a man is a scientist and he works in a science laboratory, that just because a man may have a very highly paid responsibility in some aerospace industry does not mean he knows a thing. That does not mean he has the slightest acquaintance with biology, zoology, ornithology, ichthyology, microbiology. Doesn't mean he has any bit of knowledge about comparative embryology. It doesn't mean that he has studied paleontology or geology. It just means he studied math. He studied certain select, abstracts of math, some of the so-called higher math. It doesn't mean that he knows very much about his own environment. It's amazing, it really is. We're getting so highly specialized. But you as the layman probably assume that all of these highly paid professionals must know a tremendous amount, and you leave all of your opinions to them. Well, now let's ask evolution a few questions about animal arithmetic. You know, no animal rules the world. Except man, and he doesn't rule it. He can't even rule himself. We can figure out how to put a man in orbit, but we can't figure out what makes the neighbor kid go wrong and what breaks up our marriages. We can't figure out how to keep from having family battles. And yet, you know, here are all these animals, and while none is supreme and none rules over the others, they all live in perfect balance. And by a strange occurrence, those animals, now isn't this strange? You stop to think about it. The animals with greater environmental resistance also have a greater biotic potential. That means this, that the more, well, let's put it this way, rabbits produce a lot faster and a whole lot more of them than the predators that feed upon them. Now, by what accident did this occur? You say, well, way back millions of years ago, you see, the foxes were eating all the rabbits. And the rabbits began to realize this, did they? And then somehow they just made allowances for it so that they reproduce so many times faster, it's pitiful. You've heard the old joke about the rabbits who were running away from the fox. And they said, shall we continue to run or shall we stop and outnumber them? And, you know, you can find out how many litters rabbits have in a year, and you're really amazed. A lot of people look at that and they think about rabbit fur and they go into the rabbit raising business because they think, man, if it's that easy, I can get practically rich. They have 3 litters a year with 3 to 6 per litter. Now, why is it that this balance in nature occurs this way? That every animal has a balance of these two factors. Now, you take 2 different birds, for example. What about quail? A quail has many predators in the woodlands, all types of things, from shrews, ferrets, foxes. Oh, you can take skunks and armadillos and everything imaginable could tear up the eggs and eat the eggs and attack the baby quail. Snakes will get them a lot of times. Of course, man and his sprays are bad enough, and they kill off the whole population in a whole state sometimes, like as not. Now, on average, parent quail will produce about 30 eggs a season. On the other hand, you look at an eagle. Why don't they produce 30 eggs a season? They don't. They only have one predator that might bother them, and that's man. It's almost made some of them extinct. Otherwise, the eagle would have no predator. But automatically, since there is no predator other than just man, who is a predator of all predators, of course, the eagle only lays 2 eggs per season to sort of keep everything in nice, neat balance. Now, did it just happen this way? Why isn't it the exact opposite? Those birds can't intelligently choose their number of offspring. And, you know, now you can go back and think, well, what about natural selection? The eagles were eating the quail, the baby quail and the quail's eggs and so on. All right, let's figure that that's what was happening. So all the quail died because all the eagles ate them. Is that right? Well, no, they didn't all die. They didn't. Well, how did they survive? In other words, they have not yet evolved their 30 eggs per season. They're still only laying, like a dumb woodpecker, maybe 1 egg or 2 eggs or 3. Or like an eagle, they're laying 1 or 2. Or like an ostrich, maybe 1. Now they suddenly find out, well, here are these eagles preying upon us, and we've got to begin laying more eggs. Is that what they did? You ask a few questions like that, and you see if you can stagger along through a few million years figuring that came true. Now, this Planned Parenthood is fantastic, and all the way from black bears to bacteria, there's a fantastic balance. Bacteria reproduce in seconds. They double every 20 minutes in certain types. But the black bear, who has virtually no enemies at all, produces maybe one cub or at most two per year. Can you imagine what would happen? You know, you can be glad that bacteria don't reign on the earth, because if just one little bacteria reproducing under normal conditions were to just go on unchecked and there weren't other bacteria to kill him off, the entire earth would become a mass of seething bacteria covered with a mantle bigger than the present earth in just 2 days' time. And that is a mathematical fact. 2 days, you could have bacteria double the size of the present Earth. But fortunately, they keep killing each other off. Now, if a pair of mice and their young multiplied for 2 years with no enemies, their offspring, laid end to end, was stretched from New York City to California and back, plus 25 times around the Earth, plus 200 times to the moon and back, and there would still be enough mice left over to scare all the women in Pittsburgh and feed their cats for a year. And that's a fact. That's mathematics. And the mice didn't figure this out by themselves. They just didn't. But how did it happen that way? Now, rabbits would do the same. You know, you look at this and you begin to get a picture of the balance in nature. If mice, if bacteria or rabbits infested the society, you could appreciate the balance a lot more. But because it goes along in pretty good balance, generally, except where a man interferes and fouls it up himself, no animals give us any real trouble. So there's nothing to really bother the perfect balance in nature. Now, whenever man does try to bother the balance in nature, he really has to pay an awful price for it. For example, we've imported birds and we've imported insects and various rodents and things like that into various other places that are supposed to be in a particular environment. And nearly always it backfires on man. Nearly every single time. Long ago, there was a farmer down around Gold Beach and Brandon in southern Oregon. And he was farming right along the seashore, and the sand dunes kept blowing inland and getting into his crops, and he would do everything. He would try to plow a certain direction, and he would try to build fences, stake fences and everything of the kind. This was way back in the 1800s. And nothing would work. But he was from Scotland, and he was going back to visit his folks, and so he got an idea while he was in Scotland. He thought about the Scotch firs, F-I-R-Z it's spelled, which we now call in Oregon Scotch bloom. And any of you Oregon farmers know what that is, but now you're probably grinding your teeth already. But anyhow, you can blame it on this fellow down around Gold Beach and Brandon. Because when he got there, he decided he'd take a suitcase full of those seeds back because the stuff had tenacious roots and ran along underground, very thick stems, was almost impossible to kill, and very thick, heavy foliage that would make a terrific windbreak, he figured, to become a natural fence, and it would stop those sand dunes from marching over hill and dale all over his farm. So he went back on the sailing ship around the Horn, and this is an actual true case. You can look it up if you'd like under F-I-R-Z in any encyclopedia. And he planted them there, and so they took off, all right. They marched all across the landscape into Northern California and all up and down the length and breadth of Oregon, and probably by this time have infested all of Washington and Idaho and other states beside. He really started a regular epidemic, and so it wasn't too many years after that, the citizens of Brandon, who were by now surrounded by the weed, heard a cry one early morning of fire, fire, and they couldn't get out, and the whole town was burnt to the ground with a number of deaths. I forget how many, because that stuff dries out and the fire got started in it. Well, here was a man that figured he would take a plant that worked in one part of the world as a hedgerow or a natural windbreak, and he would plant it and work it somewhere else. You know, you hear about people killing all the predators. Farmers get into an area and they kill all the foxes. So what do they got? A rabbit epidemic or a mouse epidemic. This happened up around Maricopa and Taft, California one time, where they were inches deep running over each other. A regular plague came into this town and people had to shut themselves indoors, and even then the mice found ways to get in. It always happens that way whenever man begins to interfere. When there are no predators, however, when man is not interfering, when man is not transplanting or carrying a creature from one place to another, it's always in perfect check, always in perfect harmony. You know, we haven't even learned how to keep our own population within reason. But with animals, it's automatic if you leave them alone. Now, which came first, you know? How did it get started that way? If different animals ruled the earth at one time or another, as evolution tells you. Everywhere you look in nature, you find perfect balance, perfect harmony, a tremendous amount of thought. And every time you read in some of the historical or some of the natural works or scientific works, even from evolutionists for that matter. You find these admissions that science is still wondering why these animals do what they do. They're still trying to find out what makes salmon migrate and spawn to the same gravel shoal they left up a creek when they were only a little tiny fingerling, not much out of the fry stage, as they say. They wonder about these eels, where they have to leave Europe, and they have to leave to go to coasts off South America about a month earlier than the ones that come up into the Great Lakes region, and yet they leave at a certain exact time, one number, and they never do intermingle. They leave ahead of time and they arrive just at the spot. They wonder about the Arctic tern, and why that crazy bird way up in the Arctic tundra would wheel out of there at the very precise moment in August when there is more food available up there, better weather, more insects, and everything they need to sustain life, and yet migrate clear to the South Pole, the longest migratory bird path there is. And of course they figure, well, maybe he was seeking colder climates. Well, that doesn't make a bit of sense, does it? Because he's got to cross the equator. And the farther he goes toward the middle of the world, the hotter it gets. Any tern millions of years ago, seeking to fly to a cold place, would have thought, boy, it's getting hot down here. And he would have turned around hundreds of miles before he ever got to Ecuador. But no, they go right on through the torrid, the tropical, and right on down to the South Pole, leaving, mind you, at a time when their environment where they are is at its very best, and where there is another month and a half of good weather. But they leave so as they can arrive at exactly the right time. Well, if you say all that can just happen, that's believing with a lot of faith, I'll tell you that for sure. That's believing a whole lot more than just thinking maybe somebody kicked together a Swiss watch out of some clods in a field. If you think trucks can back up to a loading dock enough times over a few million years to automatically dump a five-room house with a key and a door, you can believe evolution. If you believe a monkey by accident can type the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica full with cover and all supplementary notes with a pronouncing table and all the pictures and plates, then you can believe in evolution. If you can believe your intelligence, your body, and your mind were produced by something less intelligent than yourself, maybe you can believe in evolution. I don't know if an evolutionist out at sea with little water and no food would believe in evolution, but somehow I doubt it. It's about time you began to prove these things to yourself and to become a little more observant. Now, you may not realize that in the attempt to harmonize a lot of the beliefs of the Bible with evolution, people have said that even angels married women before the flood, trying to explain that account in the sixth chapter of the book of Genesis. Here's an article that shows you about some of the ancient men, the giants that walked the earth. It's entitled, Did Angels Marry Women Before the Flood? And it's free of charge. Just mention the one about angels marrying women. You'll find out what paleontology says about it. And also write for this article on giants on the earth, which talks about the Neanderthal man. You'll be interested in that one. And also the booklets, Does God Exist? And the Proof of the Bible. They're free of charge, no price. The Plain Truth magazine will come along. And just because you write for it doesn't mean you're obligated. No one's going to call upon you. There's no follow-up. It's absolutely free of charge to you. Your subscription has been paid. That's The Plain Truth, the world's unique magazine, and absolutely without charge to you. So write for it by sending your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure you list the call letters of your station, listen to them carefully, and jot them down. First of all, we want to know where you heard the program, so jot down the call letters of your station and then write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. The address again in just a moment, and so until next time in the series, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.